You're listening to UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell, and this is The Smartest Doctor in the Room, where real medicine meets real answers. Each episode, I bring you honest conversations with some of the brightest minds in health and medicine. Let's get started. Toxic mold exposure in the home is dangerous to your health. I see patients every week in my practice who are suffering from the effects of toxic mold. And in many cases, they were living in a home where they didn't even know mold was present. That's why I recommend to patients who suspect they are ill, possibly from toxic mold exposure, to obtain a test from Immunolytics, a company that specializes in mold detection with simple mold plates for your home or office. The mold plates are put in various rooms of your home and then left open for an hour. They are then closed up and you observe them for 5 days. If the mold plates show growth, you can send them back to Immunolytics and the company will analyze them and interpret the results for you. Please see the link in the show notes to order your mold plates from Immunolytics and use the code Smartest Doc to get a 5% discount.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so Barbara, I remember when I heard about this syndrome, when I read it actually in Dr. Crook's book, The Yeast Connection, decades ago. It seemed unimaginable. How would you explain to somebody on the street, as best that you could, what is auto-brewery syndrome?
Auto-brewery syndrome is when the little microbes in our guts, which mostly do wonderful things for us, but if they get out of order and overgrow some of the fermenting organisms that we all have, they can create enough alcohol in the system to become intoxicated. And when the body crosses that threshold to intoxication, to a detectable alcohol level from those fermenting organisms, that's auto-brewery syndrome.
Hey, that is a good, simple explanation. So this is very important. This actually, again, I said we have a very interesting connection because I wrote a book called Conquering Candida, where in one of the initial chapters to really capture people's attention, I actually described the case of auto-brewery syndrome that I had seen in my practice. We're going to get to this, I hope, later, how I think auto-brewery syndrome and Candida are all kind of on the same spectrum. You know, obviously just auto-brewery being more rare. But maybe you could also mention, too, because I think this is so important, why would somebody develop auto-brewery syndrome? Is there a genetic predisposition? Is it from certain foods? What's your experience with that?
I have not seen anything that indicates a genetic connection yet. Doesn't mean there isn't one, but I don't think any of our researchers have found that. So, but what we are seeing is a lot of predisposing conditions. So, for example, diabetes, obesity, a high carbohydrate diet, which so many of us have in the Western world. We have,
Correct.
You know, high processed foods and a lot of sugar in our foods. So diet is a big component. Antibiotics. People who take more antibiotics have a higher risk of candida and auto-brewery syndrome. And you're right, it's on a spectrum. So we're seeing a lot more people nowadays because of these exposures.
Yeah, I think you really explained that very well. You know, again, one of the things I mentioned in my book, but I also mentioned in the case report that I did with auto-brewery syndrome, and when I looked at the literature when I was doing research for my book, it wasn't that unusual for, again, this is just off the top of my head, for example, the case that I described in my book was a woman in her 50s, lovely woman, she used to like to drink socially, actually gave it up because she used to feel a little bit too tipsy if she had more than two drinks, so she gave it up. And then this was the interesting part of the case, which I think you'll relate to. She had gotten sick. I can't remember if it was a sinus infection or whatever. She was on a couple of rounds of antibiotics. And then what happens too, when you're on antibiotics, her stomach got bad. So then she got put on proton pump inhibitors for a few months. And then the event happened. It was probably around holiday season. She went to an office party. Didn't drink alcohol, just had some cake and a lot of carbohydrates probably. Got in her car by accident, whatever, went past the stop sign. The cop comes out of nowhere, pulls her over, smells what he deems alcohol in her breath, has her do a breathalyzer. Remember, she didn't drink alcohol, she figured no problem, and she failed. And that began the series of issues for her with these DWIs. And it wasn't until, she swore that she didn't drink anything. And they kept on saying, as I'm sure you've experienced with some of your cases, they were like, okay, no, ma'am, we know, there's a problem here. Go to AA, the whole thing. And it wasn't until she was referred to a doctor, a gastroenterologist, who knew how to evaluate Ottobrewer Brewery syndrome, which we're going to get to later. And she was diagnosed. And, so to me, again, a big common theme, as you were mentioning, is high carb diet. You get like this fermenting gut. Definitely, I find antibiotics. The big things I find for Candida are antibiotics, proton pump inhibitors, which are very strong
Yes.
now. Unfortunately, sometimes being on the birth control pill, of course, corticosteroids, even when they're topical. A lot of patients are using asthma inhalers that have, inhaled cortisone, which is getting into the gut. So, this is to me what I see in my practice. And again, I think the Ottobrewer syndrome is probably the most extreme form of it. It's bewildering to people. And maybe you can share with the listeners. I think they'd be pretty interested. I was when I, read in your book, like, what happened with your husband? Here he was, this very upstanding man. And I think you guys were going to church, and all of a sudden he was having these, what you, I think, deemed embarrassing episodes. So maybe you could explain to the listeners what happened.
Sure. It started back in 2004, and he had his first episode at a family dinner. And it was noontime, and he just sat down in a chair and went to sleep. And he's a nurse and was working shift work. And so I thought, well, maybe he's just tired. But then when it came time for dinner, I had a hard time rousing him. I couldn't wake him up. And so I thought, what is wrong here? And everybody in the family was asking me, what's wrong with Joe? What's wrong with Joe? And I didn't know. But later on, he woke up and then he ate some food and he was fine. And we went on about our lives. It didn't happen again for about 6 months. So I kind of had put it out of my mind, just thinking he was tired. And then it started happening more frequently. And so he had more and more episodes closer
Was he
together.
drinking alcohol at
And
that time, like occasionally or
yes, he was a
occasionally?
social drinker, and
No.
we would have a glass of wine here and there. He drank a couple of beers. His favorite was beer, so he'd usually have a couple of beers, and I'd have a glass of wine, mostly on the weekends, certainly never when he was working or on call.
Right.
But the episodes started getting closer together, and my first inclination was maybe he has hypoglycemia or he's becoming diabetic. He's got type 2 diabetes. I didn't know. So, of course, we took him to a doctor. They ran a bunch of tests looking for hypoglycemia, diabetes, all those things. He did the glucose challenge. Everything came back normal.
Really.
And yet, these episodes kept getting closer together and more serious. And I thought, maybe he's got some neurological problem. Maybe he's got a sensitivity to alcohol, and the beers that he's drinking are, registering higher than they should, or he's too sensitive to it. I just didn't know. So again, I encouraged him to go to doctors. He went to a neurologist, a cardiologist, on and on. And one day he was so bad that I thought he was having a stroke. He couldn't speak a word. I asked him if he was okay, and he couldn't even formulate a word. And he was stumbling around, couldn't really move his limbs very well. So I called an ambulance, had him go to the hospital. And it was there that they found his blood alcohol level was 0.37. So we were both shocked. And it was the hospital where he worked. So there was a bit of embarrassment and shame. And of course, people jumped to that conclusion that he's just tied one on and, he's drunk. And even the doctor even said that to me. And I said, but he's been having these episodes when he hasn't been drinking. And the doctor said to the doctor in the ER said to me, that's impossible. And I said, well, okay. I mean, I couldn't argue with him at the time because I'd never heard of Ottobrewery either. And so, I thought, well, maybe he is an alcoholic and we need to discuss that and we need to deal with that. So we did. We went home and talked about it, and he kept saying, I'm not, I'm not.
It's really right.
Hi, everyone. I know you may already know from listening to my podcast that I specialize in treating patients with toxic mold exposure. It's become a serious problem for many years as we deal with the hurricanes and floods throughout the country. You know, even simple bathroom water leaks from a toilet in your home over time can contribute to mold buildup. I can help patients that suffer from the symptoms of toxic mold, but I also rely on the patients getting their current residence inspected so they are not continually being exposed. My go-to person for mold exposure is Joe Reese. Joe is a certified mold inspector with decades of experience. He is super thorough and gives you a straightforward assessment and tells you whether it's safe to live in your home or if there is mold. I should know, I used Joe when I moved to my new home 4 years ago. Fortunately, when I moved in, I smelled the unusual odor in my basement, and I immediately called Joe. He came over with his instruments, and he found the problem. Afterwards, I had remediation, and the problem was solved. Joe does inspections all throughout the country. He welcomes calls to his cell phone at 908-451-4592. You can also reach him by email at jprconsultants7929@gmail.com. Remember, mold in your home is not a good thing, but thankfully it's a problem that can be fixed.
It's like a person says, I'm innocent.
It's
I'm innocent.
Crazy.
You
well,
know,
and I know
like
that
he's
a
a
lot
good
of,
lawyer.
yeah, exactly. And I know a lot of people who drink do hide it. I get that. I'm
Yeah,
aware.
that's, yeah.
And I did enough investigating around the house that I believed him. So that's when I started looking for another cause and hit
Yeah,
on
so let's
Otterbury.
get into this too, because again, you being in the healthcare field was a little bit of an advantage, and you're obviously bright, and it was very personal to you. This happens a lot in
Yes.
medicine.
Yes.
So you started to do the deep dive, because I even read your book. You can really get into the biochemistry and everything of this. So maybe explain to the listeners also what you started to do, and then if you could explain a little bit, because again, I have a background in this too. What did you end up finding that explained the, I mean, I think you looked into the literature, you saw this Otterbury syndrome existed,
I
and
did, right?
then you start to do your own little research, and then what's your understanding? I love to explain to the listeners, and I'll give my input too, what is really going on? Because people are saying, like, because you even mentioned one of the really interesting things too, all of us produce a little bit of alcohol in our gut. That's normal. We tend to think, oh no, you don't produce any unless you drink. Not true. It's funny, I didn't even know that. So maybe explain for the listeners, like, what's going on biochemistry, physiologically, that.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked. Drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It's really pretty simple, and it's one of the reasons I love Otterbury is because I think it's a very concrete example of how our microbes in our guts
Yes.
can cause a problem. And we've documented this in the literature now. So there's this really interesting study you mentioned. People, all of us, making tiny bits of alcohol. There's a study out of Saudi Arabia where Saudi Arabia is, it's illegal to even have alcohol. They have no alcohol in the country. It's against the law to drink or have alcohol in your possession. And they did a very large study of thousands of people and measured their blood alcohol level. And while it was a tiny amount, almost everyone produced alcohol. And that's one of the key studies that shows us that
That's fascinating, right?
we
You're
all
taking a
do
population
this.
where there should be a zero, and
Right.
it's not. Wow.
Right. And so what's happening, we've discovered now in our latest research that was just published in January, has shown that most of the organisms that ferment are in the proteobacteria. It's now called Pseudomonas datata, but it used to be proteobacteria, and it's the E. coli, Klebsiella pneumonia, those things. And now when I say E. coli, I bet most people in your listening audience have heard of E. coli because we all have that. We know we have it. We know where it is. It's largely in our stool. We all have it. And that's one of our fermenters. So the process, the biological process, is that starts to grow out of control. And again, you can imagine if antibiotics are lowering the level of other of our good bacteria, then those E. coli that are fermenting, and not all of them ferment, but the ones that are fermenting can grow out of control. They overcolonize, they keep colonizing, and then they produce alcohol that gets into the bloodstream, and it actually skips the first pass liver metabolism. If we drink
You skip
alcohol, it
it.
goes right to the liver and starts to metabolize. It from if it's in the lower in the gut, the small intestine or the large intestine goes dumps right into the bloodstream. And so this, I think that's one of the reasons we see these extraordinarily high blood alcohol levels.
Fascinating.
It just it misses that first pass. Now, of course, it makes its way back to the liver and begins to metabolize. But if the liver's overwhelmed with that amount of ethanol, then you're going to have that extreme intoxication.
Interesting. Now, I know you mentioned in the book too, this is where my connection with this really resonated, that the other thing that really I find helps ferment the gut are yeast. Now, you mentioned there's a yeast called Saccharomyces cerevisiae, I believe I'm saying that right. I also always feel, I guess the way I explain to my patients is about Candida albicans, because, and what's always thrown off the conventional doctors is this. I trained in the AIDS epidemic in the late 1980s, early 1990s in New York City. And we saw our fair share of AIDS patients. In fact, my hospital was like a referral center. And those patients clearly were immune compromised, the immune system was depressed, and opportunistic organisms like fungal things like yeast, they would get thrush, certain kind of very unusual rashes, even fungal pneumonias, the whole range of things, along with other stuff. So that's what I think my colleagues typically think of if you have, quote, Candida. You have to have either have AIDS or maybe chemotherapy that really depletes you. But what I see in my practice every week, and I guess I see people from all over the country, they have this history of being on antibiotics for long term. Maybe they were treated for Lyme disease for 6 months. A lot of my patients, especially the younger ones, were treated with like minocycline for acne for 6 months or a year, and or people with chronic sinus, all of these things I think really disrupts their microbiome. And as you just said, which I thought so important, I consider, for example, Candida and really Ordo Bruteri like the classic microbiome disease. I mean, I think in the future we're going to see a lot more, but it's one that just hits us in the face that is so obvious. So again, I guess I just wanted to ask you a little bit of the difference, like just regarding the fungi and yeast. Again, I tend to think of it as Candida albicans, and I think in the book you mentioned Saccharomyces. Cerevisiae. Now, is Saccharomyces also a normal gut yeast that's found in the? Because Candida is. I mean,
Yes,
we all have
you're right.
Candida.
You're absolutely right. Candida is in most all of us. I mean, we can't say
So,
100%, but it is. And Saccharomyces is not. That is a.
are people getting the Saccharomyces through like the diet, let's say through breads or whatever else?
Well, that is one of the theories. So my husband had the Saccharomyces cerevisiae. He used to do homebrew. And so I wondered if there wasn't a connection. And I asked people. So I've worked with over 300 people now that have a diagnosis of Ordo Bruteri syndrome. And
Wow.
I don't ask every one of them, but I do when I'm having a, more detailed
Yeah.
conversation with them. I say, "Were you ever a home brewer?" Just out of curiosity. And quite a few of them were.
Really?
They either bought homebrew beer from other places or they brewed their own. And I wonder if there isn't a residue of the Saccharomyces that's lingering in the gut and producing some more alcohol.
Interesting. Now, also you mentioned the book. I know from my practice too. It's a big part of the treatment is following a low carbohydrate diet so you don't get exacerbations.
If you've been following the podcast, you may know I practice holistic functional medicine and immunology. In fact, at Mitchell Medical Group, we've been treating chronic fatigue patients for 3 decades. It's critical in this work to have a trusted pharmacy that can compound medications for our sensitive patients' needs. ITC Pharmacy has been our go-to pharmacy the entire time. They can make medications ranging from thyroid hormones to dye-free medications for all of our highly sensitive, even allergic patients. If you or your holistic doctor are looking for these very specific patient medications, you can contact ITC at 888-349-5453. They have licenses throughout the country and can have medications delivered right to your doorsteps. My patients have been so pleased with their service, and you will be too.
I mean, it's not meaning just avoid alcohol. It's meaning avoiding probably breads, cookies, you know, all those kind of things that could raise your sugar, that seems to feed into, in my estimation, the yeast overgrowing. So would you agree? I mean, do patients have to stay on that type of diet in your experience with the cases that you've seen for life? Or do they at some point, are they able to, kind of go back to a little bit more balanced carbohydrate diet? What's your experience?
We have a number of patients, including my husband, that were able to go back to a more normal diet. I won't say it's ever what he was eating before he had Autobrewery syndrome. But I tell patients all the time that, you know, my husband has not had a flare in 15 years. We consider him cured. He's back in balance, though, and that balance is still fragile. You know, we don't want to overdo it. So I recommend that people go on a very low carbohydrate diet for 6 to 8 weeks until they know they're not having any more alcohol episodes, and then begin to gradually introduce and your more sensible carbohydrates. You know, have a carrot.
Complex ones,
some,
good ones. You know,
exactly.
Right. Maybe people confuse when they hear carbohydrates, they always think of bread and sugar.
Well,
but,
sure.
But
exactly.
Vegetables are carbohydrates.
Vegetable, exactly.
Right,
so I always start with the vegetables and tell them to eat them with their proteins and with their fats, not by themselves. And then see how it goes.
That's
and
a great
if,
point too. You know, it's one of the things I mentioned in my book on the diet section that again, when people are even going to try to do some carbohydrates in their diet, it's best to start off if you can with protein, like at a meal. This way you're a little bit fuller and you'll probably balance your sugar a little bit better, you know,
Right.
versus
Yeah.
going straight
That's
to
great.
the carbs right off the bat. You know, one of the other things too, I forgot, I think you do mention in your book, and it's mentioned in my book, Conquering Candida. What I found to be the game changer is that these patients need their microbiome rebalanced. So I use a combination of vitamin therapy and antifungal medication, typically for 3 weeks, because I know a lot of doctors are afraid of antifungals. They're fearful of the liver. Again, I've done this for 20 years, had really good success. I've actually checked with the CDC, the head of the CDC of the fungal branch, who deals with a lot of the really serious, like pneumonias due to fungal infections. And he was going to doses 3 times higher than me. He said to me, Dr. Mitchell, I rarely see any problem with this. I'm more afraid of antibiotics than I am of antifungals. But I was just curious, again, in your experience working with all these cases, is that typically what these patients need to sort of get rebalanced? They need a course of antifungals?
It depends. So
Yeah.
Most of the case studies that we have for the last 50 years cite a fungus, and that is empirical evidence. It's anecdotal information. They try antifungals. Sometimes it's successful, sometimes not. My husband was one of the lucky ones. They actually cultured the Saccharomyces, and then he was on antifungals, and it seemed to work. We have other patients now who have, and sometimes the doctors will just try, rather than culture based, they will just try a broad spectrum antifungal. And so may or may not have success. And then they get more aggressive with those antifungals. We've even had patients on mycofungin.
Yes,
We've had
I've had a
IV
case where it was
mycofungin.
critical.
Yes.
The young woman, that's how I opened my book. I had this one woman came to me from New Mexico. She was one of the most difficult cases I ever saw. She had candida and yeast coming out of her eyes, out of her breasts,
My goodness.
Vaginal area. I mean, it was just, I mean, all her doctors were totally perplexed. I mean, that's why she ended up coming to see me. And I worked with her. She came up for a few weeks. I tried everything I could. I was stabilizing her, but ultimately she needed IV mycofungin, which I've rarely only used with a couple of patients in my whole
Right.
career, but it did help her. So there is help for these patients. I mean, I think that's the bottom line too. I
There
mean, you have to
is.
know they're not crazy, and their
There
family
is.
members should know they're not crazy.
Finally,
So.
we've demonstrated this in a cohort of patients that these organisms are really there and they really are fermenting. And we do caution our doctors to do culture-based treatment rather than trying different medications. We've had a couple of success, where they've cultured the Klebsiella pneumonia and they've given rifaximin or Inipipen, I can't even say that
Ipipenem, yeah,
medication.
it's a tough
Thank
one,
you.
yeah.
Thank you.
That's
And
interesting.
that has worked. So we encourage people
Interesting.
to go with the culture-based if they're taking medication. Now, I always say,
Wait, when you say
start the
culture-based,
diet.
how are they getting that culture from stool culture?
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
The station that makes you feel good.
No, we do. We
An
our
endoscopy?
yes. So our
Right.
doctors in New York and California are recommending the EGD colonoscopy, and so they don't do a total cleanse, but they take samples throughout the gut, all the way
Interesting.
through the gut, small intestine, large intestine, everything, and then culture those because you can have an organism in the small intestine and not get it from the stool
Yeah,
sample.
there's a big difference. Yeah,
So.
no, it's interesting you're bringing this up too. I was been really fortunate on this podcast. I interviewed what I believe is two of the best gastroenterology microbiome researchers in the country, Dr. Mark Pimentel at UCLA and Dr. Satish Rao at Georgia. I mean, unbelievable doctors, really the best.
Yes.
Dr. Pimentel, who I've been on a couple of times, really has taught me so much about the microbiome. He's doing state-of-the-art work. Dr. Rao, which I so much commend him, he's really the one who's published the papers, calling this diagnosis SIFO, small intestinal fungal overgrowth. Now, what did Dr. Rao did, I'm going to get to something really interesting in a second for the listeners. What Dr. Rao did, to prove his point, he did do, he had, you know, they were able to do it because they had, I think, patients that had reflux on top of the irritable bowel stuff. So they did upper endoscopies, but he came up with, as Dr. Pimentel, a special sleeve that goes on the endoscopy equipment so they could get a sterile culture. And that's what interested me, that Candida grew out in like 70% of the patients, that he was able to get this sterile culture. And that's what it inclined him to give these patients 3 weeks of Diflucan or fluticasone, and they, majority of them got better. But this is what I wanted to say to you, because I was thinking about this a lot, and I'm on the rampage now to try to get this done. That's obviously a very invasive test. Not a lot of people want to go through that. And the irony is that the police, they use a breath analyzer. When they're pulling somebody over, for DWI to check their alcohol. And it's the same thing I think that happens or is really being used in auto brewery syndrome. I mean, right? You're measuring the alcohol. Now, there are other things like, I'm sure you're probably familiar with too, because I know you know the physiology of biochemistry, like acetaldehyde. I've been trying to, press a company to come up with a breath test very similar to the SIBO breath test for this.
Is he in Pennsylvania?
What's that?
Is he in Pennsylvania?
Is who?
The doctor you're encouraging to come up with
the
test.
Oh, no, it's not a doctor. I'm working with a company.
A company.
Trying to...
So we have a doctor. Yeah, I can connect you with the doctor that's actually got the device that measures the acetaldehyde. Because we
really?
Think that's a
oh,
big
wow.
factor.
Wow,
we think that's
wow,
a big
wow.
factor in this, and that all of these things are sort of leading to that metabolic liver.
I'd like to take a moment to let my listeners know that my new book, Conquering Candida, is now available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. If you believe you suffer from Candida, this is the first book in 50 years since the original book, The Yeast Connection by Dr. William Crook, to give credence to this underdiagnosed and undertreated condition. If you also want to understand gut health and the microbiome, I also believe you will enjoy this book. I do appreciate if you read this book to rate it on Amazon and provide your comments and a review.
Disease that
exactly,
we see so much of.
Exactly,
so there could be low levels of alcohol. There could be a lot of acetaldehyde that we're not capturing
right.
with the
because
BAC.
A lot of people get that brain fog, which obviously can be
yes.
the alcohol, but apparently acetaldehyde could do that and cause fibromyalgia.
Dr. yes.
Jimmy Cal also, who's like the world expert in IBS, and he's the one who discovered that it was due to SIBO in a lot of these cases. But it was very interesting, a book he wrote called The IBS Solution. And, when I had him on, a year or two ago, he had a chapter where he said, they were finding it fascinating that like 40% of their patients with IBS had either chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia accompanying it. And he attributed it to, I thought it was an interesting theory that because, the overgrowth and everything, they were getting increased, what's it called? Blank on the name. It's the endotoxins. And that was, the liver wasn't clearing them. And that's what was causing the brain fog and fatigue. So yeah, again, all of this is just so interrelated. And, I think an awareness of this, as I said, because unfortunately, in our world today with all the environmental stressors, stress itself, which I know can also cause, I always say it's like eating 10 cookies. With people being treated for Lyme disease, and all these tick-borne illnesses, antibiotics are still rampantly used. And I think it's been having, consequences.
Absolutely. I think so
Yeah.
too. And I don't blame the individuals because a lot
No.
of this is systemic, that you go to the grocery store and a small percentage of the food is real live plant-based food. The rest of
Yeah.
it's in a box or a bag, and it's easy and it's cheaper a lot of times than buying and preparing whole foods. So as a society, we need to deal with that.
So what are you doing with the, the society that you formed and your committees? What's your like goal and what do you keep busy with? I'm just curious.
Our main thing is advocacy. So we get calls, probably 20 or 30 inquiries a month. People think they have Otterbury. They think a loved one has Otterbury. So we try to direct them to resources. We try to give them educational materials. And if they end up having a diagnosis, a lot of times they'll stay with us. We have a nutritionist on board. We have an alcohol addiction counselor. I do nursing consults. So we do a lot of advocacy. Our secondary goal then is to educate the broader community beyond people who think they have it or have it. And so we do want podcasts and the word out there, and we do publishing of books and articles, and we've gotten on. We had a couple of episodes on NPR a couple of weeks ago, and we're really excited about just getting the word out any way we can through social media. So we have a small group of volunteers that help with all of that, doing social media. And then the third thing we do is support research. So we have some researchers, UCSD California and in Boston, and we have completed one study where our group really recruited a lot of the subjects that were in the research study, and we have a current one in Boston now that is the fecal microbiota transplants with people who have refractory Audabury syndrome.
Oh, wow. So you're
And
using it for that. Interesting.
yes, and we again recruited and referred those patients to the research study. So
Wow.
we do a
That's
lot of
great.
supporting of the research, and we'd love to be able to raise more money and support more research, but that's a future goal.
Let me ask you about the legal side. I mean, I maybe hope, I'm sure it comes up in your cases too. Let's say
Yes.
a person gets a couple of DWIs and they swear they weren't drinking and this whole thing starts to spin out of control and they're going to lose their license or go to jail. Have you, I'm just curious, has your society or anything got been involved to help people that this becomes a legitimate legal issue?
Absolutely. So for an awful lot of our patients, that's the first time they ever know they have a problem, is that they got a DUI or they got stopped weaving or driving erratically. So they didn't know they had a problem a lot of times, and now they're in legal trouble. So we do advocacy for that. We have a page on our website of lawyers that actually have listed Audabury syndrome on their website
Oh,
and are
wow.
willing to defend our clients. I have testified now in, I'm coming up on my 12th trial that I've testified in as
Wow.
an expert witness for Audabury syndrome. A lot of times the doctors just don't have time to do that. They really don't, even though, but they're
Right.
willing to diagnose. So I go with the diagnosis and say, this client's been diagnosed and here's the explanation. So that advocacy work is very important to us as well because it can ruin lives. It really
Absolutely.
can. This is a horrible disease and people have all kinds of consequences from it.
Can you tell me again, too, in diagnosing? I think I've read in some of the articles, whatever. I think probably in your book as well. So to diagnose it, what they bring them into the clinic, they I guess give them a carbohydrate loading or like glucose, and then they follow their alcohol levels, what, every half hour. Is that somehow the protocol works?
Yes, that's the published protocol. And so for both of our research studies, that's what we required as far as the diagnosis, because that is a firm, very clear, I won't say it's easy to do, but it's doable. And we've actually turned to outpatient testing because very few clinics or hospitals are set up to have an observation of up to 24 hours. Now, most patients will have an episode within 4 to 8 hours if they have the right carb loading. So we give the glucose in the beginning, a carb, whatever carbohydrates the patient knows will cause their episodes. They typically eat that, and they don't bring them from home because it has to be an observed setting where they have no access to alcohol. They haven't brought their own food, and then we test on a protocol where it's baseline in 1 hour, 2 hours, 4 hours, 8 hours. I'm not going to remember all of them, but you just keep testing. And they do a breathalyzer too, because if you get to the interval where it's between 8 and 10 hours or 8 and 12 hours, that's a big gap. And the episodes tend to be a high elevation and then drop quickly. So we ask them to use their breathalyzer too and get a PRN draw if the breathalyzer shows.
Oh, by the way, is it so? It's not, you're not drawing for blood alcohol. It's still all breathalyzers,
No,
or is it some?
we're drawing blood. But at
Interesting.
the intervals are often wide enough apart. Like I said, if you go from on hour 4, you draw blood, and then you're not going to draw blood again for till hour 8. That's a 4 hour gap. So you want to test with the breathalyzer in between. And
Yeah,
then
why
if
couldn't you just do with the breathalyzer? Why you really do need the blood alcohol? Is that just more definitive?
Especially for a court of law. Yes.
Oh, yes.
So
Okay.
that's the gold standard in a court of law because their breathalyzers are not all the same. And you can have a breathalyzer that disagrees with another breathalyzer and disagrees with the blood test.
That's
So
interesting.
we
Okay.
do the blood test
You
to
know, one other
confirm.
thing about with diet with this, I'm just curious about your opinion because I think you mentioned something that I might be a little bit in disagreement with. I tend to find that when the patients have these kind of issues, and I find candida overgrowth, and I would think Audabury syndrome, they already have a fermenting gut. And I know I have had this over my career where I've helped get people better. And then sometimes a few years later, they call me up. They go, Dr. Mitchell, everything's back. I'm sick again. Da, da, da. And I'm like, well, what's going on? What happened? Because most of the time, once we really cure them, they're, for the most part, cured. And they'll say, well, I was so healthy. And I saw on TV, eating all these fermented foods like kombucha and kimchi. This is good for me. I said, no, it's not good for somebody with a fermenting gut. Do you find that could be an issue for some of these patients that they really have to stay away from things like that?
Yes,
They do. Okay, so
and
you're in agreement.
alcohol, cigarettes, dipping, snuff, all
But what about
kinds
the
of
most some of the
substances.
Asian foods, like the heavily fermented foods? I think
They've
that rots
fermented,
their
yes.
gut, you know?
We just say, don't do this, don't drink alcohol. Stay on a low, and my husband, even after 15 years, is still on a fairly low carbohydrate diet.
Yes.
He eats
Okay.
a lot of vegetables, a little bit of meat and fish. We have an occasional treat, but it's not it's not half a pie. It's an occasional piece of cake on his birthday or something. It's not every day like a lot of people. So,
What people don't realize is it's better than a GLP-1 drug for keeping your weight under control if you're
that's
on a low
right.
carb diet. I'm actually worried, just to say the last thing, I am worried about with the GLP-1 medications. Because yes, they do have their place, and again, for people who are very overweight, but it does slow gastric emptying, and I'm concerned. You know, we're hearing
Yes.
already about GLP-1 breath and some issues, and I think so. Again, as doctors, we have to be really very aware. So,
Yes, this is
is
a
there anything
huge
else we haven't
experiment.
covered, Dr. Cordell, that you'd like to mention as we're finishing up?
Just our website address, otterbury.org, and that we're available to do advocacy and education. We're happy to talk anywhere, anytime, and talk to patients, potential patients, people that think they have it, and get them some referrals.
I think you're doing great work. I loved your book, The Gut Makes Alcohol. I recommend for anybody. I mean, it's just an interesting read with the case stories. It's so well written.
Thank
So thank
you.
you for taking
Thank
the
you.
time to do this.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for joining me here on UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell. If today's conversation was useful to you, please share it with someone who could benefit. You can find every episode of The Smartest Doctor in the Room wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, stay well.